Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we have a great topic that we're going to be discussing, the first of a two-part series on global warming with Dr. Meryl Singer. Christy, I think this is so important, and I think we're just going to get into all kinds of really interesting issues.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to it. But first, how are you doing today, Adam?
Oh, I'm doing great. I think we've got some incredible research that matters that
we
I want
sure
to get
do.
Into. But I also want to let all of our listeners, Christy, know we are actually going to be conducting some focus groups. Well, we're not going to be doing it, but some research associates are going to do some focus groups from listeners like you all out there to help your health improve and remain a source of practical and easy to understand health information. So any of you out there that would like to maybe participate in a focus group to give feedback on how to improve your health for Christy and myself that makes it better for listeners like you, you can visit yourhealthradio.org and find out about how to participate in a focus group. Or you can email yourhealthunc@gmail.com. That's yourhealthunc@gmail.com. And you can even earn some extra cash.
All right. Well, that sounds...
No, you can't do it, Christy.
I'll do it.
Any of our listeners can. But let's go right into some incredibly interesting research about lifestyles. All this research is about lifestyles.
It is. The first one is about using CAT scan screening to reduce lung cancer death.
Yeah, I heard this actually a couple years ago when there was some research that came out that suggested that maybe our patients, older patients with who smoke should get CAT scans and that we might be able to pick up early lung cancers. But the data at that time wasn't great, and so we haven't been recommending it. What do we find now?
Yeah, well, this was a study that was published in the journal Radiology from the National Lung Screening Trial where they took smokers, almost 54,000 current and former heavy smokers in age 55 to 74 to find out if you screened them with a CAT scan versus an X-ray, would there be any difference in how long they lived?
Yeah, and it turns out those X-rays don't really do anything. So if you're a smoker, don't think that getting a chest X-ray is going to provide you any benefit in picking up lung cancer early. But the CAT scans showed a slightly different story.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. There were 350 lung cancer deaths in the group that had the CAT scan screening, compared with a lot more, 440 lung cancer deaths of people who got the X-ray. So basically, there was a 20% drop in mortality or death from the getting the CT screening, which made them even stop the study because it was so beneficial.
Yeah, so the lung cancer deaths went down by 20%. Overall death from any cause went down by 7%. And they stopped the study early because this was so dramatic. Though it's not quite like this is all, you know, good news for smokers, because the biggest thing they didn't really say is that you still have a lung cancer risk that regardless, because these people are still smoking. These people needed to quit smoking.
Right. And it does not address the benefits of programs to help people stop smoking, which would reduce their risk more than doing a CAT scan to maybe pick it up early. But I don't know. It'd be interesting to look at it head to head.
Well, and
dollar.
Yeah. Well, and the other problem, and I wrote about this, Christy, on a blog, which you can also find on Your Health Radio, that says, you know, in addition to quitting, there is a problem here that there were a lot of false positives, that for every one who had a positive cancer, there were multiple instances of people having things that didn't turn out to be real, but they had procedures, and you get radiation with your CAT scan that can cause cancers of other types. So there are lots of problems here that aren't really addressed in this study.
Yeah, so certainly we need to pay attention as more studies come out, but it is promising.
Okay, well, speaking of smoking and promising, I bet if I have a relative who smokes, I promise you I'm going to try to get them to quit smoking so they don't get Alzheimer's.
It's true. So, I mean, this is a study looking at yet another reason to quit smoking if you're a smoker, that there is a link between heavy smoking in your middle age and the risk of developing Alzheimer's or a kind of dementia.
Yeah, we know that people who smoke get hardening of the arteries, not only in their heart, but also their brain. It can cause strokes. And it turns out that Alzheimer's is one type of dementia is higher in people who are regular smokers as they age than in people who quit smoking.
Yeah, and this was a study that actually showed a dose effect. So a difference compared with non-smokers, people who smoke 2 packs a day or more had 114% increased risk of dementia, which is more than double than people who smoked a little bit less, who were at higher risk for people who, of course, didn't smoke at all.
Right. And even if you smoked a half a pack a day, you still had a pretty significant increased risk, 37%. And if you smoked that 2 packs, they had 114% increased risk. These are very large numbers in the public health realm. And, you know, you would think that as people get older, they would have either quit or unfortunately died from their smoking. But there are a group who continue to smoke. And maybe the thought of getting Alzheimer's, which really scares all of us, it's scary.
So right. It might grab you more than the fear of a heart attack or stroke. I don't know. But hopefully it will.
Well, I know that we all care about Alzheimer's. And our next research that matters is perhaps something that we might be able to do to prevent Alzheimer's.
Now, this was a study about the vitamin B12. And its link potentially to protect against Alzheimer's dementia.
Yeah, and the journal Neurology, appropriately, really looking at the effects of supplements like B12 or folate on people with dementia. And this study was done, I think, in Finland.
It was, and they took blood samples from 270 Finnish seniors who did not have dementia and then followed them 7 years later and found that 17% had developed Alzheimer's dementia. And the ones who didn't develop it had higher levels of this portion of the vitamin B12 in their blood.
Yeah, and it doesn't say what the effect is of taking vitamin B12,
right.
And that's the big caveat here,
yeah.
That you can't like hang your hat on it that, oh, I should go out and take vitamin B12 to prevent Alzheimer's. But it suggests if you have higher levels of B12, naturally, you're probably at lower risk for getting Alzheimer's. And if you have very low levels, maybe you're at higher risk.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot to do about this. Right now, all we know is that it is an association. But having a healthy diet and not smoking, as we know from the other study, could be protective.
Well, and B12 is found in a variety of foods, predominantly things that animal products. Very few plant-based products that have B12, and other than plankton, which probably you're not a big, or I am not a big plankton eater, but folate didn't have any effect here. So don't take the folate thinking it's going to protect you against Alzheimer's, and stay tuned for B12. What's our very last research that matters?
The last one is also about diet. It's about red meat being linked to esophageal and stomach cancer risks in U.S. adults.
Yeah, this was a very large study of over 500,000, one of the largest ones I've come across, Christy, in all my years of being a doctor, that were followed for over 12 years to look at, for those that develop cancer of the esophagus or the stomach, what relationship there is between the red meat intake.
And they found that the people who ate the most red meat, people who are at the top 20% of intake of red meat compared with other people, were almost 80% more likely than those who were at the lowest end of the spectrum of eating red meat to develop esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, which is an uncommon type of cancer, but it's cancer of the esophagus.
And then also those who were in the higher level of the meat intake, particularly those who maybe grill their meats and get these what are called HCAs or heterocyclic amines, compounds that form when meat is cooked using very high temperature, that those people had higher risk of certain types of stomach cancer.
And, I mean, surely, as with everything, we need more research to fully understand this. But I think all of these studies really speak to the benefit, or at least the last few, of eating a healthy diet in moderation.
And unfortunately, what is moderation for some people, which is that you have red meat with every single meal,
that's true.
Is not the moderation I think Christy is talking about here. I think we're talking about probably, if you want to lower your risk of cancer with diet, you should probably be eating less red meat overall. And for many people, that's probably once a day or less.
That's true. So we've had a chance to talk about screening for lung cancer.
And CAT scan, maybe if you're between ages of 35 and 55. And heavy smoking, quitting will lower your risk of Alzheimer's.
Talking about vitamin B12 and a link to Alzheimer's.
And then lowering your cancer risk by eating less red meat.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show, but we're going to take a break. And when we return, we'll be talking with medical anthropologist Dr. Meryl Singer about global warming. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about global warming and its effects on health. And we, this is something that Adam and I are passionate about and care about, the effects of what's coming, and really interested in learning more about that from an expert that we have today, Dr. Singer.
Yeah, we'd like to welcome Dr. Meryl Singer, who's a medical anthropologist and professor in the Department of Anthropology and a research scientist at the Center for Health Intervention and Prevention at the University of Connecticut, and an author of a recent book, Global Warming and the Political Ecology of Health, Emerging Crises and Systemic Solutions. Welcome to the show, Dr. Singer.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Singer, Adam and I love to hear people's stories. We'd love to hear how you followed this path in your life and career to become passionate about global warming and to write a book about its effects on health.
Well, there's many things that fed into this, and just living at this time, it's hard not to be aware of global warming. But the very specific pathway was came out of a introductory medical anthropology book that Hans Baer, who is co-author on the global warming book as well, and I wrote several years ago, and we were trying to put together what would be the key topics that we should address in introducing medical anthropology to undergraduate students. And as we were listing topical areas, I believe it was he that, you know, we really have to talk about global warming because, for one thing, no other introductory medical anthropology text does that. And so we decided to focus on that. Both of us had some past history in environmental activism dating back to our own college days. And so we wrote that chapter. And in the course of writing the chapter for the intro book, we sort of decided it was really way too much material to cover. And we were, of course, constantly learning new things. And so we decided to write this book, again, it's a co-authorship.
Yeah, well, you know, we have to thank you for taking that extra step, and it's no small feat to go from a chapter to a textbook on this. And one of the things I really like about this book is that you do bring together information in ways that allow people to read about it and understand it in ways they may not really otherwise. And I guess one of my questions, talking about Christy and your path, is you know, you talk about global warming becoming really aware of the problem and the different stages. When did you become aware that this really was a global issue and that you needed to do something about it? How long ago did that happen, and how did it happen?
Well, it certainly was something that was coming, you know, over a number of years as we began to, you know, hear the reports of various indications. So some of it was just the media reports. Also, you know, anthropologists tend to work in various parts of the world, and by reading other anthropologists, you can hear about a lot of different places at once, and the kinds of environmental changes that anthropologists were seeing, from glacier melt and disappearance to drought. Hans Baer, my co-author, lives in Australia, and Australia has been in the midst of a multi-year drought. So he was seeing it very directly. So it really, you know, came out of that. But also, you know, it's deeper roots are as a college student, I was active in environmental issues, belonged to, I believe it was called the Ecology Club, so it was, sort of a general, that kind of general awareness. And beyond that, one of the things that has characterized my work and our collaborative work has been looking at how wider structural factors impact health, and including the role of corporations in shaping health. And so these things came together at that moment that I mentioned in writing the introductory book.
So talk to us a little bit about bringing that home or bringing that together for our listeners who we've all heard, we all know that global warming exists and that there are bad things coming as the world gets hotter. But I don't know that everyone really understands what's happening now, or I certainly would love to hear what is happening now in terms of health impacts from global warming, and what does the future look like? Big questions.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that we tried to do in this book or along those lines was in the discussion, the public discussion on global warming, there is kind of this sense that, well, yes, some things may get worse in some places, and in other places, growing seasons will be longer, and some positive things will come of it. And that intrigued us, that notion, and we began to look especially at, was that a realistic assessment? And what became clear is two things that really sparked our concern. One is that the effects of global warming are multiple. It's not a single thing. It's many different changes at once. And so while a particular region may have some benefits from one scale, they suffer deficits on another. So in a place like New England, where I live, there may be changes that result in improvements in the growing season, for example. Not that we're a major agricultural state, but we certainly have an agriculture here. But the fact that we're a coastal state, and one of the impacts of global warming is rising sea level, means that we could see extensive flooding. So we might benefit in one regard, but suffer in another.
Yeah, I think you also talk about in your book that higher mountainous areas, some of them will get far more rain, but of course that then breeds far more flooding downstream, and then you have these areas, substantial areas across the world that are already suffering drought that are more likely to suffer more severe drought.
Well, the drought impacts are clear and are already being seen. But global warming is, as I said, complex. So some areas will see much more intense rain. Others will see drought. And so there's really, people are often confused about global warming because they only, there may not be an unusual amount of rainfall 1 year or 2 years or 3 years running. But in some part of the world, as we've just seen, this year with the massive flooding in Pakistan, the forest fires around Moscow because of greater heating, you have to take a whole world view and you have to look at it through time. So that this idea of there being multiple effects and in some that they will be different at different points in time is one of the issues that motivated us. The other is the issue of environmental justice, that the countries that most produce greenhouse gases and the communities that most consume energy may not be the ones that most feel the adverse health effects, it may be the least productive, the least resource places, poorest communities that actually feel the worst effects. And so there's this great imbalance that reflects an ongoing pattern.
We want to be able to continue that thought after the break. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Meryl Singer, about global warming and its effects on health. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Meryl Singer of the University of Connecticut about a book that he's a co-author on, Global Warming and the Political Ecology of Health. And Dr. Singer, right before we left you, we're giving some, I think, cogent examples of the global interconnectedness of global warming and its effect on human health. And I'm wondering if we can continue a little bit in this conversation. You're talking about drought and flooding, but in your book you really talk about this connection in much broader terms. Talk a little bit about the effect on food production, and then maybe we can go right into infectious disease a little bit. But talk a little bit about those health impacts that global warming is likely to have.
Well, I was mentioning, Adam, before we broke, about the drought in Australia. And one of the impacts of that drought has been a significant reduction in rice production, which Australia is an important global producer of. When Australia could not produce the quantity of rice that it had in previous years, the result last year was food riots around the world because the price of rice suddenly went up, and people who were dependent on rice, which tends to be people in places like Haiti, which we know what happened subsequently, there were riots in the street in Haiti, but in countries around the world, because people could not afford to buy a staple of their diet.
So it's not just was there enough rice to feed the people in that area, but many multiple layers of downstream effect of that.
Exactly, because we live in a globalized world in which all countries are intimately connected economically and otherwise, and a change in one place has ripple effects everywhere.
And you talk about, you mentioned Haiti, and I'll be down there in just a bit. The recent spread of cholera, that the flooding brings with it this spread of potentially these vectors of infectious diseases. Talk a little bit about what we know is likely to happen with global warming and infectious diseases.
Well, several things happen. One is that as the temperature goes up, and including winter temperatures, do not get as cold, the range of various vectors begins to broaden. Those species that are constrained by cold weather can move in new places. So now we have West Nile disease in the United States. We have it here in Connecticut, and that was not a disease that was here in the past. So we have diseases moving, especially those that are either propelled by a vector like a mosquito into new places, or pathogens that live in the ocean. If the ocean's warm, they can move to new places that they hadn't been before. So diseases are on the move as a result of global warming.
You mentioned your book Lyme disease, and I wasn't really thinking too much about it until what you were just talking about. Of course, you're in Connecticut. Is that an example of, you know, in previous times, as the cold weather would have killed off the ticks, but now they don't die as much, so therefore there's a proliferation? Because we see, Christy and I see tons of tick-borne illnesses increasing over the last 5-10 years.
Well, there's definitely been an explosion of not just Lyme, but of course several tick-borne diseases, including, of course, ticks that are multiply infected, so that when someone's bitten, they get not one tick-borne disease, but several at the same time, which may be one of the, you know, problems that we're having in understanding whether someone not is or is not infected. And, so definitely that's another example. And we've had multiple examples. We're in a period of rapid discovery of new diseases, especially pathogenic diseases, virus, bacteria, etc. Global warming is part of that story. Other aspects of global change, what we're doing to environments in other ways, is probably also an important part of that story. Because one of the facts with global warming is it doesn't hit us by itself. It hits us in interaction with other environmental degradations that we cause. And these interactions complicate the health consequences.
Certainly, a very complicated aspect, very interconnected between all these different factors that I really, honestly, hadn't considered, that infectious disease is moving because of vectors with mosquitoes, and just the way there's so many layers that are affected by the global warming. And we're talking with Dr. Merrill Singer of the University of Connecticut. And Dr. Singer, I wonder if you could paint for us, so these are some examples of things that are happening now due to global warming. But looking at the data and the way that we are progressing, what is the future, the near future, look like? Is this give us a little picture of what the next 5, 10, 20 years might look like.
Well, barring some very significant mitigation efforts, I think we will continue to see increases in harsh weather, that is, hurricanes and tornadoes, flooding, those kinds of things, that those rates will increase. We'll see a diminishment of winter in some places, which will have effects in terms of snow melt and a lack of snow melt, which means increasing drought. The American Southwest, for example, has a major drought problem already, and that's likely to get worse. We're likely to see indigenous communities around the world that are dependent on particular microenvironments and don't have the resources to make radical changes, to be faced with environmental refugee situations, lack of access to clean water. There are a number of different ways that it is likely that the health impacts will be increasing throughout the world in different places, different ways.
I just want to let our listeners know that this is the first of a two-part series, because we knew this was such a large issue, we really couldn't do justice at all to discussing it and then also discussing potential ways that we can address this, which so we'll be doing that in a very upcoming show and talking with Dr. Singer again. But one thing you talk about in the book that I think it's important to address now, Dr. Singer, is this idea of a tipping point. There's been books written about tipping points for all kinds of social and anthropological phenomena. Talk for a second about the tipping point here, because this is, I think, will be a lead-in for what we need to talk about next time, which is a change.
Well, when it comes to global warming, the critical tipping points are those points at which things have changed enough so that it doesn't really matter what we do anymore. We have set in process cycles that can now run on their own and complicate environmental conditions. Let me give you one example. One of the impacts, of course, of global warming is the melting of the tundra. And in the tundra, under the tundra, there's an enormous quantity of methane. Methane is a very intense greenhouse gas, about 20 times or so more damaging than CO2. Once the CO2 caused global warming melts the tundra, then the tundra releases the methane, which further blankets the Earth, causing further warming. Even if we don't do anything, even if we stopped all CO2 production, which is highly unlikely, that the system would continue to heat up on its own without our inputs. So there are a number of those kinds of tipping points where we push the system, the ecological system, past the point where it matters anymore, and hence our ability to mitigate and reduce the damage lessens, and we don't get worse.
We're going to have to come back to that, because it makes me feel like anxious, but that's what I need to feel right now. And I'm certain that all of us need to feel that what can we do as individuals and as societies, and that will be a great starting point for our next conversation.
We are certainly looking forward to part two in a more positive and active aspects of what we can do individually as a community on an international scale to really make a difference. We've been talking with Dr. Merrill Singer of the University of Connecticut. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Singer.
Christy, Adam, thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. On House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your health questions and concerns. And you can write them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we'd like to ask our producer to read some of the questions we have today. Julie?
I recently went to my family physician, and he asked me if I'd ever been diagnosed with ADHD. He said I seemed to have a hard time staying focused in the exam room, and in his opinion, that sometimes meant ADHD. This was really interesting to me because I'd never been diagnosed with it, but after reading and thinking about it more, I think he's right on target. I think I have had this all my life, and it does make it much more difficult for me to do many things like completing tasks, finishing conversations, studying, and even reading. What do you think?
Well, thank you for sharing. I think that's wonderful that you have that kind of relationship with your doctor, that the doctor might bring up something that maybe wasn't the reason you came for that visit.
Yeah, let's first off define ADHD, Christy, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, sometimes known as ADD. We hear about it in kids a lot, but we don't hear about it too much in adults. But We do hear about it.
It is less common in adults, but it sounds like this might be something that was happening for your whole life. And so maybe you just never had that diagnosis when you were young.
What kind of symptoms do adults have with ADD? What do you see, Christy?
For adults, you hear about people say they zone out in the middle of a conversation, or they're very distractible, hard time staying on track, hard time listening to what other people are saying, maybe overlook details of something.
So in the exam room, this sometimes will come about if a patient is in five places all at the same time and the doctor is getting overwhelmed. So sometimes it's the person listening to it that feels overwhelmed because the person maybe is so many different places.
That's true. And I do recommend that you and your doctor go through the steps for a more formal evaluation, because it could be, I mean, there are things like depression or anxiety or other medical problems that could present in similar ways. It's worth exploring for sure, and there can be treatments that can help.
And the treatments, for the most part, pretty safe. And so hopefully you and your doctor will get together, and you wrote a very focused comment to us. So thank you so much, whether you were on any medication now or not, we don't know. But thanks
really
for writing. Julie, what's our very next house call?
I'm in my 70s, and recently I've had increasing amounts of pain in my legs, groin, and calf. I have high blood pressure and used to smoke, but I don't take any medicines that I think are causing this. A friend of mine said that her husband was diagnosed with peripheral vascular disease, and I wondered if this might be something I might have too. It certainly does get worse when I walk long distances and gets better with rest. Your thoughts?
Well, that sounds pretty classic to me, actually. The smoking history and the pain that happens worse when you exert yourself and gets better with rest. But I don't know, Adam, how do you diagnose peripheral vascular disease once you hear a story like that? That sounds like it's possible.
Well, first off, we know that if your friend had it, then you're probably going to have the same thing, because we always get what the friends seem to have had. But, you know, in this case, I do think some studies can rule this in or rule this out. Mm-hmm. A lot of us, you know, people think they could just get like a plain x-ray, but that doesn't usually do anything. It doesn't really show you, because what you're really looking for is how well does that blood pump through that organ. And so a lot of us will, in primary care, get what's called an ultrasound or a Doppler, kind of looking at the flowing and the waves as they go through there to see if there's any restriction. And that's a really good non-invasive first step.
And for some people, quitting smoking is always the right thing to do, and you've already done that, so that's good. For some people, there are medicines. They don't work great, and some people do need surgery, but there are options for treatment. So thank you for sharing, and good luck.
And hopefully, if it's not this, it'll be something else equally treatable. What do you have very next, Julie?
Why is it that so many doctors don't take the time to listen? My mother recently broke her hip, and the doctors who took care of her came in and out of the room so fast you would think they had a train to catch. They seemed to resent our questions so much so that by the time we left, we were really pretty confused.
Wow. Wow. Well,
it's really unfortunate.
I mean, first off, we have to thanks for sharing, because, you know, whether I hear that myself, if someone had to say that to me because I was that train coming in and out and not really realizing I was a train, or whether it's Christy and I here, we have to say we appreciate hearing things even when they're difficult.
And, you know, sometimes it's true if you're in the hospital that different doctors are in and out, or you don't know who's actually caring for you. It's true that even in an outpatient setting, you might see a team of people and not quite realize what's happening. But I would encourage you to, when that happens to you and you feel confused, to speak up, or if you're an advocate for your loved one, to ask questions, ask the doctor to come back and sit down.
Yeah, and even you know, I think it's okay. We have to empower all of us to be advocates for ourselves and our loved ones. And here your mother is in a very vulnerable position with a broken hip. It's very scary. You have lots of questions, maybe even when you don't even know what they are until the doctor starts talking. So I think you need to say, we really need a few more minutes of your time. If you can't do it right now, can you come back in 5 or 10 minutes? Can we meet you here back in an hour? Mm-hmm. Negotiate for the time that you need. And then if you still don't get it, you really need to give the feedback. You're not listening.
That's great advice. So hopefully the next time you feel that way, advocating and really asking for what you need, hopefully the doctors will step up and do that. I think, you know, doctors want to do it, but a lot of times we don't realize that we're not doing it well.
Julie, what's our very last house call?
I have a complaint about the healthcare system. Recently, I was in the hospital, and I was told I was going to leave at 10 in the morning. Unfortunately, 5 hours later, I was still waiting for all the paperwork to finish, and I didn't leave until 6 p.m. By then, it was dark and cold. Not an optimal time to leave for a sick patient starting to recover. Is this right?
Well, you're right. It's not the right way it's supposed to happen. So
no.
you're right.
Yeah, you're right on that. And unfortunately, this happens a lot. I'm not sure in your situation whether the doctors were really waiting to finish the paperwork or whether maybe they were waiting for another test, some results that they didn't communicate to you. They were waiting on some labs to come back before they felt comfortable sending you home. But clearly, someone didn't explain to you what was happening.
And, you know, and this goes against what we're trying to actually do. We're really trying to have it that's a very efficient coming into the hospital and very efficient leaving the hospital. Part of that efficiency is really doing it the right way. And you're absolutely right. I don't find that there's almost any excuse for having someone go home late in the afternoon or evening. Nothing good really happens health-wise after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Bad things can happen. The weather's getting dark now. It's getting slippery, rainy, tripping, falling. All kinds of things can go on. So what can we recommend? What do you? How are we doing things, Christy, to try to get people out earlier?
Well, as a hospital system, there's a big initiative for early discharges, for writing those orders and getting the paperwork started first thing in the morning, for communicating more effectively with our nursing staff so they know what to expect and can get their work done in a timely way. But I think as a patient, it'd be good to be bringing up this conversation with your team to say, hey, what time can I get out of here? I really want to get home in the morning to make sure everybody's on the same page. But thank you for sharing. We've had a chance to talk about a couple different things with the hospital system that can go not as well as we want.
Involve better listening and better coordination of care and tests to help diagnose attention deficit disorder in adults.
And also about peripheral vascular disease.
Well, thanks for joining us today on Your Health, and we hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can send your own stories at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081. You also can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter. We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Merrill Singer.
And we want to remind our listeners one more time that if you would like to participate in a focus group to give your health feedback on how to improve future shows and even earn some extra cash for the holiday season, you can visit yourhealthradio.org or email yourhealthunc@gmail.com. On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.